Death on the Lido by Martin Foreman, performed by John Vernon.
I never spoke to him. I knew his name, but it was years before I realized who he was. I was in Paris, a student at last, searching for something to read among the bouquinistes. A thin, unshaven man with a tired, dog-eared collection pushed a volume into my hand.
"There, monsieur, read this. A marvellous book, the story of our times."
It was The Abject, an old French edition. I was ashamed of my ignorance and showed it to the friend I was with. "You know it?"
"Of course," he said. "It's his masterpiece. He died before the war."
Only that evening, as I sat down to read and saw his name, did I once again remember the old man in his chair. The hazy sun, the sea, and the sand. We'd been at the hotel for a week when he appeared. I had been bored on the long train journey as field after field rushed past.
"Find a boy to play with," said Maria, while Mother and Mamselle dozed in our compartment. "But there are none in this carriage," I said, "and Mother told us to stay here."
"Always doing what Mummy says," Olga jeered.
"Don't you?" I asked.
"Yes," she replied, "but I'm a girl."
I fell silent, and for the rest of the journey wavered between self-pity, anger, and hatred towards all three of my sisters. The hotel was full at the height of the season. At dinner the first evening, we followed Mother around the room, greeting people we knew. I was happy to see the Andreevskys, especially Yashu, a boy a little older than me, and there were other families and children that we would get to know, but as I looked round, I was slightly disappointed, as if I'd expected someone. An old friend or a new acquaintance who wasn't there. Most days, whatever the weather, we sat on the beach with a parasol and table in front of our cabin. The sea air was good for my health, Mother said, who was never convinced that the shortness of breath I'd suffered when younger would not return. She would calmly read or write letters, while Mamselle fussed over towels and bags and other paraphernalia. The girls sat and gossiped, hiding from the sun and brushing sand off their clothes. I didn't realize that they didn't enjoy themselves. Too old to play games, they could only talk, or go for walks no further than Mother could see. I, meanwhile, a 14-year-old boy, could play with other children, build sandcastles, rush into the sea, or lie on the sand whenever I wished. All I had to suffer was Mother's frown, and Mamselle's fussy reminders not to exert myself, reminders that I usually ignored. 14. Neither a boy nor a man. During the day, I was a child, running, laughing, playing hide-and-seek. My favourite refuge was an alcove in a distant corridor. If Yashu was the hunter, he would leave me to last. If pursued, he would slip in beside me, whispering private jokes that I didn't always understand. At night, at dinner, everything was different. Sometimes I felt very adult and spoke with an adult's gravity, paying great attention to what I said. Then my sisters would laugh at me, and I'd be angry and stay stubbornly silent until Mother threatened me with bed. At other times, I resented sitting stiffly in stiff clothes as my sisters laughed their silly laugh, as Mother and Mamselle discussed our education, and the guests around us clinked their noisy cutlery and talked and talked and talked. There were too many people, I told myself. I wanted to be alone, or with a close friend, or far, far away. In truth, I didn't know what I wanted, only that within me there was an unknown need, an itch that tormented just out of reach. Oh, to be free, I thought to myself, ignorant of what freedom was, of what it might be for. One morning, I came out of the water shivering with cold. Wrapped in a towel, I lay back on the sand and closed my eyes. In that strange darkness, my mind wandered between consciousness and sleep, between individuality and the universal, between self-knowledge and self-discovery. I sensed new emotions that I neither recognized nor understood, that I wasn't yet ready to embrace. Slowly, I opened my eyes and in the harsh sunlight saw only one thing, an old man in a deck chair reading a book. I knew he was old from his clothes, the careful manner with which he turned the pages, his calm expression. Disorientated still, it seemed to me that the world was a void in which only this stranger floated. Unthinkingly, I stared at him, trying to understand him, until his glance fell on mine. Suddenly, aware of my rudeness, I closed my eyes, turned my head, and wished him away. The day was hot, and I began to doze. When I woke, he had gone. Over the next few days, I saw him occasionally, a man alone, dull and uninteresting. One morning after breakfast, he seemed to leave, saying goodbye to the manager, fussily distributing tips and walking out of the hotel. But that night he was back in the dining room at his usual table, carefully studying a newspaper and delicately spooning his soup. Perhaps it was the next day I realized he was watching me. As always, we were on the beach, and I was in a solitary mood. I left the others to walk along the water's edge, kicking each wave as it fell over my feet. Whatever I was looking for, I did not find. Eventually, I ambled back, glancing over the figures on the sands. There was the old man, a newspaper on his knees, flapping in the breeze. His hat covered his eyes, but the closer I came, the more certain I was that he was watching me, that every step I took, even the rise and fall of my breath, was as intense to him as my first vision of him had been to me. The closer I came, the stronger seemed his gaze. Embarrassed, without knowing why, I could neither look at him nor stop him looking at me. I could only keep walking because I was already moving. At last I passed him and found myself safe in Mother's greeting and smile. At ease again, I knelt at the water's edge to build a sand castle, a great feat of engineering with towers and bridges and tunnels and moats. Other children helped, but it was my castle, and I allowed nothing done without my approval. By lunchtime, it was complete, monumental. When Mother came down to inspect it, I looked up and saw the old man's empty deck chair. But it was not long before I saw him again. And again. And again, everywhere I went, the old man was there. In the corridors of the hotel, I could pass him quickly, look down or away, but on the beach he sat for hours, a book on his knees, his eyes half hidden by his hat, but always, always watching me. It was the same at dinner, where Mother insisted that I sit on her right. His table was near ours, and every so often his eyes would rise from his book, sweep the room, and linger imperceptibly on me. Why was he watching me? In later years, I came to recognize, even expect, that same expression on the faces of strangers who came into my life. But I was too young then to know what it meant. His gaze felt like a punishment that I didn't deserve. I began to hate it. I wanted to make him stop, but didn't know how to do so. I certainly couldn't tell Mother. A hotel guest is watching you, she would say, eyebrows arched. You must have offended him. Then my sisters would laugh at me for being frightened by an old man. All I could do was stay silent and hope he would soon leave me alone. One night I had a fever after staying too long in the sun. I lay in bed, alternately pushing the covers away and pulling them over me. Suddenly, convinced that the old man sat in the room watching me, hat in hand, eyes piercing, his thick moustache curled into a frown. He was paying me back for my rudeness that first day when I had stared at him on the sands. More than that, he was judging me, punishing me. He knew everything about me. He had summed up my history, listed all my faults. Nor was he just the old man. He was every man who had authority over me, the tutor displeased with my work, the policeman suspecting me of broken windows, my father disappointed in a lapse of manners. Yet I had done nothing wrong. I had not lied nor stolen. I had drunk no spirits, smoked no cigarettes. I had only stared at him by mistake. As I lay there sweating, his bespectacled eyes stared relentlessly at me. I couldn't breathe. I kicked the covers away, tore at the neck of my nightgown. Dimly, I was aware that I was ill. I should pull the bell rope and summon Mother, but I wanted to see this through alone. With sudden strength, I sat up, pulled off my nightgown, and fell back on the bed. Apologize, I told myself, apologize to the shadow hovering over me. But when my mouth opened, I gasped, "No, no, no," until my voice died and the old man faded. The room was empty, a shaft of moonlight pouring through a gap in the curtain. Covered in sweat, I stood up to get a towel and took out a fresh nightgown. I looked at it and let it fall back into the drawer. Nightgowns bothered me like the stiff collar of a clean shirt. But what if Mother came in to wake me? I could lock the door, even though it was forbidden. For the first time, I had survived an attack without Mother or Mamselle rushing in with hot water and menthol. Still shaky, yet feeling strong and adult, I turned the key. Lying back on the bed, stretching out as the sheets rubbed against my naked body, seemed the most delicious thing I could ever do. Sleep came soon and was untroubled. I woke early. Looking out of the window in the dawn light, I saw on the beach only a man and a boy setting up parasols, and a youth in the distance painting a cabin. I longed to join them, to stroll along the sand, to dive into the water, wash away sleep and my childhood. I would be a wanderer, a sailor setting out to sea, a man amongst men, rugged, strong, tanned and free. In a year or two, I would be old enough to set off on the path that I, not my parents, chose. Exultant, alive, I threw open the window and breathed in the sea air, its rumours of salt and travel and foreign lands. Beware of what you long for, young man. Your wishes might be granted. In my newfound confidence, I prepared to approach the old man and apologize if I had offended. I entered the breakfast room. He looked up and saw me. As I approached his table, no longer averting my eyes, I saw for the first time that the old man's expression was not disapproval or anger, hostility or contempt. It was as if my presence both amazed him and made him afraid. Suddenly he looked down, and I found myself all resolve forgotten, passing him and greeting my family.
"Did you sleep well?"
Mother asked as I sat down. I nodded. The night's attack as far from my mind as if it had never occurred. Coffee was poured into my cup, a roll set on my plate. My sisters prattled, but I was lost in my own world. What had I seen in the old man's eyes? Whatever it was, I was no longer afraid of him. Instead, I was sure I had something to gain. From that moment on, I no longer avoided him or turned away when his eyes fell on mine. Wherever I was, he seemed to be there, or I sensed him the moment before he appeared. He seldom looked directly at me, usually focusing on something nearby, one of the children playing beside me, flowers at an adjacent table, or the dessert tray a waiter offered us. But when our eyes did meet, his gaze was strong. Hypnotic. Between us, it said, there is a mystery, a secret that only we share. Occasionally, it softened, and there were times he almost smiled at me, a slight movement of the mouth, a twinkle in the eye that dissolved as soon as I noticed it. Under that gaze, I often shivered, a sensation as keen and as delicate as when I was naked and alone. From Mother, who made it her business to know all the guests, I learnt that he was a writer, well known in Germany but deservedly unfashionable in Poland. I wasn't sure how a writer worked. Sometimes he sat in front of his cabin with pen and paper and a serious expression, but he might have been composing no more than a letter to his bank. I imagined him at a desk, eyes wild, scribbling over paper, pausing briefly to think of a word or a phrase. It was no more than a caricature. In reality, I couldn't picture him anywhere but the Lido. At any other activity than eating, walking, and resting, his attention anywhere except on me. I began to feel I possessed him. I recognized his clothes, how recently he had shaved, the books and newspapers he read, the food he preferred. Bit by bit, his appearance changed. He acquired a new suit, lighter in color and more modern in cut. His stiff hat was replaced by one of straw. There were rings on his fingers, a flower in his lapel, and a colored handkerchief in his breast pocket. In youthful arrogance, I told myself these changes were meant for me, and I tried to respond in kind, paying more attention to my behavior, acting more like the adult that I desperately longed to be. Adult! I was still half boy. And like all adolescents, capricious, often acknowledging his attention in the same spirit that I received all compliments, more indifferent than grateful. Or I would pretend to ignore him, looking or walking away when I saw him. Then I would be ashamed and unable to rest until he came into view again and I could reassure him I had not rejected him. Once, when we were in town and I had not seen him all day, he was waiting as we returned to the hotel. I smiled, as I might have greeted a friend. It was a mistake. He frowned as if I had gone too far, turned aside and walked away. When I was not with my family, there was always Yashu and other boys with whom I joked and played and fought. Yashu was the friend I told everything. I shared my dream of making my way in the world as an adventurer, and he swore to join me. We whispered and giggled the stories that all boys tell about the mysteries of sex and the powerful dreams that filled us with excitement and guilt. He would grasp me tightly at such moments, but I was too young, too naive to understand what he wanted, or to see the old man's quieter gaze in his excited eyes. More often our talk was down to earth. My annoying sisters and the time when I would join my father's law firm, his quarrelling parents, and the rank he might reach in the army. He got his wish. For a brief summer, Yashu was the pride of his town and family, until he fell at Kostyukhnovka. Time passed, punctuated by occasional trips into Venice and letters from father. I'm ashamed to admit the city bored me. I saw no beauty in it, only dark alleys and steep bridges that led from one collection of unsavoury smells to another, filled with bickering peasants, persistent peddlers, and disfigured beggars. Each Sunday we went to San Marco for the never-ending Mass. Each Sunday he would be there. I had begun to question God, and when others bowed their heads in prayer, I only half leant forward, my eyes still open. One time I turned, saw the old man sitting bolt upright, his head bare, staring at me more intently than ever before. The expression in his eyes, deep pain, supplication, need. Startled, troubled, I bent my head and tried to understand what I had seen. It seemed to be a plea for something I could not give, something much greater than I possessed. If I had been older or more precocious, I might have called it my soul. I had no idea how I should respond. I was shaken, but also thrilled. What I had seen was denied to the rest of the world, his entreaty a gift so precious that it could not be refused. It was only years later when I saw the same expression again and again on the faces of men and women whose lives crossed with mine, did I learn that the old man's need gave me power, the power to accept him or turn him away. And only years later did I realize that his presence, his obsession, his longing created a need in me. A need that has never been fulfilled. Cholera. One day, Mother told us of the disease that was keeping many tourists away. But we would not leave Venice because Father would soon join us. So we stayed, and each day the dining room was emptier, the tennis court seldom played, and fewer cabins open on the beach. I was too young to concern myself with disease and death. They were the afflictions of the poor that had not yet touched my life. Creatures of darkness and dirt that lurked in slums and corners where I did not go. Nor did I associate them with the old man, although I noticed him aging. A greyness hung over him as it hung over the city, with warm, sultry days on which the sun never appeared. His face was drawn, his colour sallow, his movements slow. One Sunday, as we strolled through the city after Mass, he followed at a distance, but he could not keep up with Mamselle's sprightly pace. Turning a corner, I looked back and thought I saw him fall. I hesitated, then walked on, angry with myself that I did not leave my family to go back and help him. It was with relief that I saw him that night back in the dining room, more animated than usual, fussing over his food and the service. The next day at dinner, I looked at his table and saw a young man in his place. A young man with unnaturally dark hair, red, puffy cheeks, and eyes sunk under thick black brows. Untrustworthy and effeminate, I told myself. Yet even as that opinion was forming, I saw who he was. He looked up and stared, and even in my youth I could understand the expression that struggled through the makeup. "I have done this for you," it said. "Do you like it? Please tell me you do." Stunned, my mouth dry and my heart pounding, I looked away, unable to talk and think. I almost spilt my soup, and when Mother asked what was wrong, I had to smile and reassure her to continue eating and talking as if nothing had changed. What I wanted to do was run away, lock myself in my room. There I could cry, shout, beat my bed, throw off the violent emotions surging within me. Only then, when I lay exhausted, would I be able to try to understand why I felt betrayed. But I could not move. While my mind swirled in pain and confusion, I could only sit, be polite to Mother, listen to my irritating sisters, and keep my eyes from the man who sat a few tables away like a snake that had crawled back into its shedded skin. "Damn you," I thought, using a word that I had never allowed myself before. "Damn you for what you have done to yourself, for what you are doing to me." That night, I dreamt of him again. The young man with the old man's eyes reached out to me, brought his face to mine, and whispered in my ear, both exciting me and frightening me. I wanted him close to me, and I wanted to push him away. He became a being both young and old, male and female, hideous and beautiful. I reached out to embrace him. Our bodies touched, we kissed, but in our kiss he faded. And I woke to find myself trembling as I clasped the bolster, the covers twisted and half off the bed. I knew what had happened, and I knew that I wanted it to happen again. What I didn't know is whether I wanted it with him or with anyone other than him. Oh, Tadju, Tadju. As a boy, you looked forward to life with excitement, convinced that the old man was the gatekeeper to a new world whose mysteries would gradually reveal themselves. But he was the jailer who never set you free. For 40 years, you have haunted me, old man. You abandoned me in Venice, but that day I picked up your masterpiece in Paris, a young man, still a virgin in body and soul, you swept back into my life, and you have never left me since. For 40 years you have followed me from Venice to Paris to London and back to Venice again. Wherever I went, whoever I was with, you were there, deep in the eyes of every man and woman who pursued me, who took me to their bed, who insinuated their lives into mine. One of them, I hoped, would give me what you promised, but none of them could. They only took from me what they wanted and left me emptier and lonelier than before. You haunted me, old man. You haunted and destroyed me. The next morning I went down to breakfast. The old man sat at his table, hair still thick and black, but his face as pale as before. As he looked at me, his expression was calmer, yet still filled with longing. Some of the night's anger returned to me, tempered with curiosity and pity and contempt. Our silent relationship had changed once again. A change that left me disturbed and dissatisfied. As I looked around the dining room, avoiding his eyes, I tried to convey to him that I wanted more from him or nothing at all, but whatever there was between us could not continue as before. That day, over lunch, Mother told us we were leaving. Father had heard of the cholera and insisted we go home. Once I might have been pleased, excited by the idea of my own room again, of my toys and books, even school, but this year was different. I wasn't ready to go. I needed to know what the old man offered me. As a child, I would have run to Mother, blurted out what I wanted. On the brink of manhood, I knew there were secrets that I could not reveal. I looked for the old man, but he was not there. Surrounded by my family, I was quite alone. The morning of our departure, we went to the beach as usual. There were few people about. The old man sat in his chair in front of his cabin, almost motionless. Yashu and I splashed water at each other. Inadvertently, some sand hit him in the face. I laughed. He grew angry. He leapt on me, and I realized how strong, how masculine he was. He knocked me down, sat on my back, and pulled up an arm so hard I thought it would break. I shouted, begged for mercy through tears, but he pushed my face into the sand. Frightened, in pain, and unable to shake him off, I could only lie there, sure I was going to die. At last he let go, and I sat up, exhausted. My mouth full of grit. I was angry and hurt. I walked away, ignoring him when he ran after me, stood at the water's edge, wondering what to do, where to go. The water had receded, leaving an island of sand. I turned and pointed it out to the others, but no one noticed. I walked forward and climbed up onto the sandbar. It was my little kingdom, and I wanted to stay forever. My family could leave Venice and leave me alone. I slowly strode the length of my small domain and turned. There was a cluster of people around the old man's chair. Afraid, I ran into the water, cursed it slowing me, tried to swim, stood up again, and at last made it to the beach. As I ran up, I saw Mother's figure, heard her taking command. Olga turned and saw me. "It's Mr. Aschenbach," she whispered. "I think he's dead." I peered over shoulders and caught a glimpse of a pale, drawn face slumped to the side. Eyes half closed, saliva dribbling from the corner of the mouth. I thought it cruel and vulgar that people should stand and stare and turned away to walk back to the sea. I should be sad, I thought, in tears. But my eyes remained dry. I knew I had lost something but did not know what, and at that moment the pain seemed easy to bear. What I did not know was that the pain would never go away.
I never spoke to him. I never spoke to him.
That was Death on the Lido, written by Martin Foreman, performed by John Vernon.
Barbary, drama and fiction.
Hear more drama and fiction, old and new, on arburyproductions.co.uk.